Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Discourse doesn't necessarily represent reality. It creates reality. It's a productive force. That's according to Jarrett Moore. He's assistant professor of research and assessment at Black Hills State University. Moore will parse this idea later today in his Geek Speak lecture, Manufacturing Reality. That's at 4 p.m. local time at Black Hills State in Jonas 110. And he joins us by phone this morning. Dr. Moore, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
All right. Is the lecture weather pending, first of all, or is it still on for today? We'll see.
Well, it's actually tomorrow at 4 o'clock.
Tomorrow at 4,
so hopefully, okay. Yeah, so hopefully it'll be cleared up by then.
All right. So where do you want to begin with this? Because this is about the idea of power and how what we say changes things versus just reflecting reality. Kick us off. Where do you want to start with this idea and your interest in it?
Okay, yeah, sure. That's a great place to start. I think kind of what I want to do is open up the idea that language doesn't just describe reality, that, like you just said, it's a productive force and it constitutes reality. So I'll start probably with a little bit of theory on power and how it operates. And one of the things that French theorist Foucault talked about in one of his books is that the power used to be concentrated, you know, with the kings and the queens and the monarchs. And then throughout the different democratic reforms, that power gets dispersed, you know, and then you start to look for where the power is and you figure out that there's no such thing as power. It's not a thing, you know, that's in the natural world that is expressed, that you find power through the expression of power. And for us, the way we, you know, kind of create reality is through language and discourse. And so that's kind of where we'll start with.
We find power through the expression of power. So let's dive into this idea of what power looks like and what people sort of think of it as. They might think of it as, you know, the authority of the police department or of the military or of, you know, a really heavy-handed sense of someone telling you what to do, the president of the United States or something like that. But this is about power that's operating in different ways, right?
Sure. And there is definitely something to the fact that, you know, the military does have weapons and the police, they are militarized and all these different things. So there is a physical presence of force. But we also have to think about how we as individuals and we as, you know, a voting public agree to and allow these expressions of force. And one of the things that I'll talk a little bit about is how people kind of consent to this. And you mentioned earlier, how did I get interested in this? And one of the things that growing up in Georgia is you start to see how, excuse me, people who kind of vote against their own self-interest and people who, you know, depend on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, things like that, vote for, you know, generally politicians who are, you know, running on platforms that will cut those benefits. And so I started thinking, you know, why would anybody do that? So one of the things that I'll talk a little bit about is kind of that phenomenon, how that works.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about this philosopher Foucault. Who is he? He's French. And what's the historical context of the time that he's thinking and writing in? What's his legacy for today?
Yeah, so he's a French postmodernist, and this is all kind of World War II era in that time period. And so, you know, thinking about knowledge and thinking about the things that we know, he discussed things like sexuality and the naming, the scientization of sexuality creates what's normal, and then it creates also what is abnormal. And then so what he's basically saying is that power is not good or bad. Discourse is not good or bad, that it's a productive force. And so when you create normal, you're also creating abnormal, and then it's given a value. And so from there, you know, you have to, excuse me, you have to determine what exactly is the purpose of the discourse, what power is it serving, and then how does it relate to people's material lives.
Right. So it's changing our perception of reality and then also changing our reality.
Yeah, and Foucault would say that it's actually doing the creation. And certainly, you know, you think of, say, more modern examples when you hear a politician talk about law and order as a, say, campaign promise, or sure. I will be the law and order president, or, you know, things like that. Historically, that goes back to, say, Nixon, the Southern Strategy, and, you know, what were they referring to when they were discussing law and order? And at that particular point in time, it became less fashionable to talk in, say, purely racial terms. So as you start getting more vague, then, you know, it codes the language in a way that the people who are listening for it will understand it. But it's passable, say, in polite conversation.
All right. So when people say in the media that, you know, something is a dog whistle to other people, or somebody says something and they call it tone deaf, that means that there's communication that's happening beyond what's on the surface. Can you elaborate on that at all?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about just keeping in that, say, law and order example, there was a good example of a campaign strategist named Lee Atwater, who was discussing kind of this very thing. And he basically said that, say, in the 50s, in the South, you could go through and say the N-word, and you could call people openly racist names, and then you would get the votes of those people who were inclined that way. As you go through the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement, that becomes less fashionable. And so now you have to use terms like, say, busing, school integration. And you can campaign on those issues while being vague enough to say that, you know, it's not a racial thing. It's a states' rights thing. It's a neighborhood school thing. And that way, the same ideas are being passed along to the people who you want to hear them in language that is tolerable for, say, everyone else to hear as well.
Right. And then go back to the idea of power then, and how that power starts to shift. And as I was, you know, thinking about this morning, I thought about, you know, sexual harassment and gender relationships in the workplace. And, you know, similar to the example you just used about racism, how does the actual power shift? So then you can use language to sort of speak to people who know that you're speaking to them, but at some point the reality begins to change as well, in spite of your words. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah, I guess I would say that I'm not quite sure how much, when it comes to something like Me Too movement,
yeah.
I haven't studied that specifically in terms of, you know, I use a process called critical discourse analysis, so I haven't studied that particularly specifically in that way, but I'm not sure exactly how much, you know, the power has shifted. I guess you could see a change in language, and you could maybe see, you know, some change in what's acceptable, but also you're not really seeing a big major shift in, say, the legal aspects, the protections for women, you know, things like the Violence Against Women Act, you know, went away in the Congress and it's no longer in effect. So, I mean, it's definitely a process. So it may be in 5 to 10 years, you may see a change, but the discourse on it has, you know, changed slightly, but I guess the power has not, I don't see really a lot of evidence that the power has shifted within the conversation.
All right. So explain critical discourse analysis then. How deeply are you looking at things to sort of see how the discourse has changed?
Yeah, so there's basically two parts of it. One's what we call diachronic. So this is kind of the history of of the discourse, of the language. And it's generally a rather narrow topic. So one I'm working on now is on the term radical, how it's used, what does it mean, things like that. So you kind of give a broad, you kind of look broadly, how's it been used in the past? And then you take what we call a synchronic cut. So you take a very small sample, maybe 2 weeks in the news media, maybe a month in the media, and you kind of look across it. And so then what you do is you take, kind of break it down to just as far as you can go with it, from the framing of the story. And that's really one of the big issues is how do you frame, how does the media frame the topic? And so then from there, you go all the way down to what we call the fragments. And that gets down into very particular language. And then you kind of come all the way back to the beginning and see where it fits into the broader discourse. And are there changes? And what does this mean for, you know, people, regular people in our material lives?
All right. So it is that, are those shifts, are you looking to see if they're happening sort of intentionally? Are you looking to see if they're do they sort of spread and kind of ooze outward? Are they intentional shifts? In the media coverage, for example, you know, reporters are reading each other's stories and pretty soon everybody's using the same word. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, for sure. And I think all of this, one of the assumptions is all of this is intentional, that it's all done intentionally to create a certain frame for the story. And so, I mean, just to give you an example, something like I was interested in the term radical coming out of the 2016 election and Obama's presidency, because one of the big criticisms is he wouldn't say radical Islamic terror. And of course, right, that became a big campaign thing. And so I'm looking at kind of the time post 2016, and it has just kind of faded away. So the framing of that term during that particular time period was exactly that. Why won't he say it? You know, you have to say it to be defeated, all that kind of stuff, right, was, you know, prevalent during that time period, but it's not there anymore as of now.
So the word radical, did that begin with, or from what have you been able to find, you know, did it begin with the opposition? Did it begin with his political opponents? Did it begin with journalists? Where did the word radical sort of first come into being a significant part of that conversation?
Well, in that particular case, I don't have that part finished necessarily right now, but, you know, a lot of that comes from, you know, Barack Hussein Obama. Was he born in the United States? Is he a Muslim? His father was Indonesian, et cetera, et cetera. And so definitely it was used as a framing of one side versus the other when it comes to something like terror. What you find now, though, is that the term is being more used towards things like the Green New Deal or Medicare for all, or, you know, higher education for all. Those types of things are considered in this particular time period to be radical ideas.
Right. All right. So let's talk about how things like that affect our material lives when we see that discourse sort of shifting. How does it, you know, because it's a fascinating, you know, analysis, but what do you know about how it changes our lives?
Well, I think the first thing you would say is that it will kind of set the parameters for the expectations and what we can expect to do from our lives. You know, I think it's interesting. I don't know if you've seen or talked about the college admission scandal that's happened over the last 24 hours. It's at least come to light, because that's one of the access and proximity to power and the discourse is one thing. And it's kind of interesting that people with the means to bribe someone with $500,000 to go to a university would not just give their child $500,000, right? But the discourse is that for someone to be successful, they have to go to high school, graduate, go to a good college, graduate, and then from there. So it's not just, say, something like economic capital and proximity to economic capital. There's also social capital, right, that goes along with kind of the status and the credentialing that comes from higher education. So, you know, probably the thing that's not being talked about in that sense is that a lot of these processes that they were using were designed for people, say, with disabilities or true need, and the people, you know, with the access were able to manipulate that for them. So in one way, they're certainly changing, you know, their material reality, but as a result, they're also limiting the opportunities for other students with need in those areas that these programs were designed for. So for a lot of ways, it really shapes what can we expect? What can a, say, a student, a high school student, or just a regular person expect from, you know, life, you know, in their own existence?
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Jarrett Moore. He's assistant professor of research and assessment at Black Hills State University. And this is all part of a little preview for a Geek Speak lecture that's coming up at Black Hills State tomorrow. It's called Manufacturing Reality. It's 4 p.m. local time in Jonas 110. And as I listen to this, to what you're saying, I'm thinking of how important it is for journalists, particularly, to pay attention to those words and the words that they use. Would you agree with that? Would you agree with the fact that, you know, when you're writing a story, when you're speaking about something, you really need to be thoughtful if you're in one of those positions where you're helping define the discourse?
Yeah, I think definitely that would be something. You know, it's one of the things that I found over time is that we focus so much on national things, whereas the local and state are the ones that really matter, you know, for us. Tax rates, all these different things for corporations, they don't really impact me directly necessarily, but local media, local, you know, the city council meetings really do impact me. But they don't get talked about in the same way because there's not as, you know, not doesn't seem to be the culture war. Everything's at stake with every single news story. So I would say I would encourage people to read more local news first, but definitely on the national media. I don't know how much separation there is between, say, the left wing / right wing media, because there's not a whole lot of difference in the framing of different stories that come out of national media, regardless of the affiliation.
Right. And one of the things I found frustrating as, you know, a journalist doing interviews around election time is that you will have people in who continue to fall back on those certain talking points. So they've decided, or their you know, focus groups have told them, this is what I'm going to say. I remember the word tribunal last election cycle over a ballot question. It was, there's going to be a tribunal. Mm-hmm. And boy, you could not get people away from that word. And you knew why they were, you know, you knew what the intent was. So people have somewhat of an understanding that gets back to that notion of power, that those words matter and they're effective at you know, achieving a certain agenda. Makes us all smarter as readers and consumers of news media as well.
Correct.
Yeah. What is that?
I was just gonna say, you're right about the focus group. One of the people who's been very influential in this is Frank Luntz. And he worked with Newt Gingrich back in the mid-90s, and they basically put out a memo and a list of words to use. When you're talking about Democrats, use these words. When you're talking about Republicans, use these words. And you still see kind of remnants of that, where you hear people say, well, we can't do this because it's impossible. You know, but that only refers to certain things, not the things that they believe in.
Tell us, before we let you go, what assistant professor of research and assessment is. I understand research, but what's assessment? Tell me a little bit about your role at Black Hills State.
Kind of really teach a lot of different courses, but one of my main roles is teaching the research classes within the graduate program within the MSCI, the Master's in Science Curriculum Instruction, and the Master's in Reading. So that's one of the big roles that they have. These students that are in the master's program will design, develop, and, you know, really do a research project. And that's kind of what I oversee for that part.
All right. Jarrett Moore, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time. And it sounds like a fascinating Geek Speak lecture on manufacturing reality at Black Hills State, 4 p.m. tomorrow in Jonas 110. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.